Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. I'm Sean Gibson, the press officer here at Bruegel, and today we bring you a new episode of the Deep Focus series, where we get into a little more detail about a Bruegel research publication in conversation with one of the authors. So, joining me today is Bruegel Research Fellow Simone Tagliapietra. Hi, Simone. So Simone, together with his Bruegel colleague Georg Zachmann, has brought together a group of leading climate and energy scholars to discuss and to highlight the key priorities for the European energy transition. And that's in line with the onset of a new institutional cycle coming up in Brussels. So I think it's good to get clear at the top of the recording that just who the other authors are, and to illustrate the extent of the collaboration. So in addition to Simone and to Georg, the authors include Jean-Michel Glachon, who is the director of the Florence School of Regulation, Pedro Linares, who's a professor at the Universidad Pontificia Comillas in Madrid, Andreas Lerschel, who is a professor at the University of Münster, and Ottmar Edenhofer, who is the director and chief economist at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. So it's quite a broad collaboration. So moving on to the publication in question, before we get to the key messages of it, Simone, can we possibly talk about the context into which we're stepping with this study and the current state of play with energy transition? How far along are we, and what are the driving forces behind it that we have to keep pursuing?
Thank you, Sean. The reason why we decided to embark in this exercise is that a new European institutional cycle is about to open up. And as far as energy and climate is concerned, the next 5 years will be key in defining how the European energy system will be shaped in 2040, 2050. Decisions being taken today will impact the energy system of Europe for decades to come, and those are the decades in which we will really make a difference in terms of whether we will not or we will be able to tackle climate change. That's the context, that's also the sense of urgency of why we really wanted to carry out this exercise right now.
So this is where your study comes in, and could you give us the key conclusions that you've made?
Yes, our key point is the following. A full-fledged energy transition in Europe is becoming economically and technically viable, with most of the necessary technologies today being available and with declining technology cost. The cost of the transition would, in our view, be similar to that of maintaining the existing system if, of course, the right policies are put in place. In short, in our view, the European Union could benefit from a deep decarbonization, irrespective of what other economies, such as the United States or China or India, are doing around the world. Europe, in our view, has a real potential to become a global leader in the manufacture of products such as wind turbines, electric cars, and new generation batteries. This, of course, entails a new industrial policy in Europe, entails policy strategy, entails policymakers also really taking the lead in this field. We think the energy transition could also and should also be socially acceptable. We don't necessarily need to face other examples like the Gilets Jaunes in the future if the right policies are put in place to control and mitigate the inevitable distributional effects of deeper decarbonization. As we said, the time to act is now, will be the next 5 years, because energy is a rigid system in which infrastructure and regulatory changes takes really decade to be fully implemented, while competition around the world, as we know, is not sleeping. Just think about what the Chinese are doing and have been doing on solar panels and electric cars manufacturing.
Yeah. So going from electric cars, the transport sector really stands out in your study for quite how poorly it's performing on greenhouse gas emissions and has done over the past few decades. So this presumably makes it a primary target for the decarbonisation and the changes that you're talking about. So what specifically can and should be done in that regard?
Right, Sean. If you look at the European greenhouse gas emissions between 1990 and 2016, you see a significant decrease in emissions in all sectors, power sector, industry, and so on, with the only exception of transport, which has actually experienced an increase in emissions of around 20% over the period of time. So this is to say that transport is really becoming a bottleneck in the European decarbonization process. We have made great efforts and great also successes in decarbonizing power, for instance, the power sector, the way we generate electricity. We are not still able to abate emissions in transport. To achieve the EU vision of carbon neutrality by 2050, much stronger policies are thus required to decarbonize transportation. And this entails really a wide range of policies. First of all, we need to try to replace the kilometers traveled by road vehicles by putting in place economic incentives such as congestion charges, public infrastructure investment in railways and public transport, while also strengthening the sustainability dimension of urban planning and development licensing. Another way to decarbonize transport is, of course, the one of promote the use of clean vehicles through a combination of stricter emission standards on the one hand for diesel and gasoline cars, and also a gradual increase in road fuel taxes to internalize fully the environmental cost of road transport, which today is still not reflected in the way we tax the transportation system. This notably implies increasing fuel taxes and car registration taxes for the most polluting vehicles. Other externalities also include congestion and accidents that also needs to be addressed. All this should be done in a very careful manner. As the example of France has recently shown, this should really be done carefully. Policymakers should anticipate the distributional effects of these measures and really target subsidies, for example, to support low-income consumers in this inevitable and much-needed transition.
Now, the work here, this study, also alludes to the centrality of electricity within the energy system. Now, this touches on some of your own previous work for Bruegel, where you've shown how dependent each EU country's electricity generation has been on coal power. I think that perhaps illustrates one of the obstacles to energy transition in this field, but could you perhaps elaborate more on what else can be done with electricity?
Yes, over the last 2 decades, the European electricity system has undergone a profound transformation, notably underpinned by a quite strong increase of renewable energy sources, such as wind and solar. That was possible thanks to technology cost reduction, but also by strong incentivizing policies that have been put in place all across Europe to subsidize, to foster the entrance of wind and solar into the system. In our view, the priority in electricity for the next 5 years in Europe is really to prepare the system for a substantial increase in renewables at acceptable cost and without compromising the security of the system. This means that accelerate the convergence between decentralization and digitalization notably by transforming the energy distribution grid into an open platform where the various decisions of multiple players, take for example the domestic renewable energy producers, community renewable energy generators, or storage provided by local electric vehicles, could interact in a transparent and flexible manner. That's it. We need a distribution grid that becomes an open platform to really allows all these players to interact in a flexible manner. This can be started by defining a common distribution operation code and by creating a common data coding and sharing framework. The next step would then be to create, in our view, a pan-European framework, establishing a coherent multi-level architecture for data exchange and power flow operation to enable a proper interaction of transmission and distribution networks, microgrid, and smart buildings. This is, in our view, really the way to foster the entrance of renewables into the system and to allow these to happen in an efficient manner.
So thinking a little beyond the EU, because they're not the only ones, of course, looking at energy transition. You already touched on China. How can the EU make the most of its competitive advantage that it currently holds in terms of low carbon technology?
Look, in our view, in this field, it's crucial to make a better use of public research and innovation funding. In our view, European research and innovation funding should really be targeted at early stage innovation cycle, notably in areas in which Europe has the potential to maintain or develop a comparative advantage, such as, in our view, in renewables, energy efficiency in buildings, bioenergy, batteries, e-gas and e-liquids. This means developing a predictable market environment for new low-carbon technologies to foster the emergence of a corresponding industrial ecosystem. That's what we need in Europe. A new innovative industrial ecosystem able to foster our competitive advantages in the low-carbon technology field.
So we've already discussed how the transport sector needs to be a priority for decarbonisation efforts. But what other sectors and what other opportunities are within reach with regard to decarbonisation in the next institutional cycle?
Look, two are the sectors that we should also look at. One is industry and the other one is building. In industry, we need to promote the recycling of materials, also by extending producers' responsibility for the management of their end-of-life products. We need to create lead markets for climate-friendly options by guaranteeing carbon prices for selected industrial processes and also increasing green public procurement and urbanizing labeling. Let me focus shortly on public procurement. Public procurement represents, according to the Commission estimates, something like 16% of the European GDP. To put a long story short, public procurement is a big slide of the European economy cake. We can make a more strategic use of public procurement in Europe. Public procurement can become a key tool for industrial policy in Europe, can be utilized to create new markets, can be utilized to incentivize innovative companies, also in the low carbon realm. So this is the typical example of low carbon mobility. If new public procurement rules, as we are starting to do now in Europe with the Clean Mobility Package, requires public administration to have a certain share of low-carbon vehicles in their fleet, that creates a market for these low-carbon vehicles and provides a signal to the automotive industry to invest on that, because they know they have at least the public market first, and then from there, they can expand to the private market. That's exactly what China has been doing for electric cars, and that's exactly, in our view, what should be done in Europe also. to talk about buildings, which have really been considered in the past as a sort of Cinderella of the European energy policy, because buildings were never really at the center of the policy makers' attention. We think that in the field, we need robust energy efficiency efforts, which were not yet really successful in the past. And notably here, what we need is a combination of efficiency standards, targeted financing policies, and cooperation between central and municipal governments. Because in this field, multi-level governance is key.
Well, I think that about brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you for listening to this deep focus on the Sound of Economics channel. And thank you very much, Simone, for joining me.
Thank you very much.
If you're interested in more of Bruegel's work, we have our catalogue of blog posts and publications and all our other podcast episodes available on our website at www.bruegel.org. I hope you'll join us again next time. Until then, bye-bye.